supplemental sheet that said they were not recommending at this point.
Okay, agenda item number 10.
Yes, this is our, since we're north, this is our timber program update, and Julia Dyer of our staff will provide some summary of the written materials that you've received and some highlights. Julia Dyer.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, members of the board. I'm here today to provide you with an informational update as to the activities conducted under the timber harvest program over the past year. This is the second annual update I've provided for you since the waiver was adopted by this board. The general waiver was adopted by this board in July of 2005. Now, this is just a overview map of southern San Mateo and Santa Cruz County's main watersheds. Highway 1 travels along the coast right here, down through the Lower Pajaro and Watsonville. So Highway 17 begins here in Santa Cruz and goes north through the San Lorenzo River watershed. Over the past year, the executive officer has enrolled 10 plans under the general waiver, which are in the approximate locations. And just as a quick reminder, each plan seeking enrollment under the general waiver is evaluated through the eligibility criteria, which takes into account various factors in each timber harvest, including cumulative impacts to the watershed in which the harvest is proposed, including the last 15 years of timber harvest. Drainage density index looks at the amount and types of water courses within the timber harvest plan, as well as soil disturbance factor, which factors in new and existing infrastructure such as landings, skid trails, roads, and so forth. Each plan is then assigned a monitoring tier based on the eligibility criteria, tier one being the least intensive, tier four meaning that the plan is not eligible for the general waiver and must seek enrollment under an individual waiver or waste discharge requirements. Tier one requires visual monitoring. Tier three is the tier that requires dischargers to monitor for turbidity upon storm events and temperature monitoring throughout the summer. And a majority of the plans that have been enrolled under the general waiver have fallen under tier three. Now, I do get a lot of questions about how the inspections I conduct over the year divide out. I've conducted 31 inspections over the past year, five of which would be categorized as violation inspections, which are basically inspections I conduct in response to a citizen complaint or discharger calling reporting that there's been a failed management practice. 16 of my inspections were conducted pre-harvest, and I conducted 10 post-harvest. Now, within those 16 pre-harvest inspections, and this is where I get the most questions because pre-harvest inspection is a very broad-based term, but four of those inspections were non-industrial timber management plan reentry inspections, which basically means the NTMP is a plan that's approved by California Department of Forestry, and then the landowner is allowed to reenter the plan over subsequent years. But every time they reenter, they need to apply for a general waiver with the Water Board. And so at that time, I go and conduct a pre-harvest inspection independent of the CDF process. And then for plans that are seeking approval by California Department of Forestry, the CDF will hold a regulatory review team pre-harvest inspection, and they actually hosted 12 of those over the past year. I was able to attend 9 of those, and for the 3 I could not, I made up at a later time with the forester or the landowner. Now, this is just a quick overview of the type of infrastructure you'll see on a timber harvest plan, and this would no way represent any timber harvest plan within Santa Cruz County, only because, as you'll see, they're doing group selection cutting right here, and in Santa Cruz County, the only type of harvesting allowed is single tree selection. But nonetheless, what you're seeing here is a skid trail that travels through the forest after trees have been cut down. You'll have a tractor that drags them to the landing, which is usually a wider spot in the road, and the logs are stacked on the landing waiting for haul trucks to come and pick them up. On steeper terrain, you might not see skid trails because the logs are being moved to the landing using a helicopter or skyline cables that pull them up to the landing. Once the logging truck picks up the logs, it takes them to the mill via what's known as the haul road, where the trucks continue back and forth over the plan. So with that in mind, I want to provide you with the types of things I'm seeing out in the field during my inspections. Now, I want to say that every photo you'll see in this presentation was taken by me, and I provide the date I took the photo as well as a brief description of what you might be seeing in that photo. So the reason I'm providing this photo is this is a landing. I took this photo post-harvest back in February. And as I mentioned in the previous slide, this is where they stack the logs during active harvest. And this photo shows that you're not seeing any signs of erosion or any other condition that might raise a concern about water quality or the threat to water quality. This is a photo I took on a pre-harvest inspection of a haul road. And again, as you can see, there's not evidence of erosion or any other conditions that might concern us about water quality. And the reason I provide this photo, even though I took it on a pre-harvest inspection, this is a existing haul road. So there's already been at least two timber harvests in this area where this haul road was used. And as you can see, the haul road is in excellent condition. And these are both very representative of the types of conditions I see. Now, as a demonstration of the types of conversations I have with foresters out in the field regarding conditions that may be a threat to water quality, I have this picture here of a skid trail. I took this photo last month on a pre-harvest inspection, so this is an existing skid trail. And as you can see, there's a gully running through the skid trail. It's about 1 foot wide by 1 foot deep. So I had a discussion about the forester about how this will be addressed, because this could raise a concern for water quality if that sediment moves into a water course. And the forester committed to what's known as backblading and tractor compacting, so filling in that gully. And then he's going to modify the drainage above that skid trail to reduce or eliminate any concentrated runoff to that skid trail and eliminate the gully. This is a photo I took of a haul road. And the reason I'm showing this is this is a culverted crossing on that haul road. The culvert runs right about here. But due to the drainage structure of the road, a lot of the drainage is concentrating in this section right here next to the culvert. And some of the residential folks in that area installed those pieces of lumber in an attempt to address the erosion, but it's not working. So since that timber harvest is coming through, and I talked to the forester about how this will be addressed, they committed to restructuring the drainage of this road so this vulnerable point is no longer receiving concentrated runoff and exacerbating the issue. And then they'll be removing these pieces of lumber and installing more appropriate erosion control practice. Now, over the past year, the executive officer has issued 3 notices of violations on 2 separate plans. Both of these plans are in the Pajaro River watershed. The first one is East Fork that received 1 notice of violation, and the St. Francis plan received 2 notices of violation. And all 3 of these notices of violation relate back to the same failed management practices, which is logs that fell into the water course. So these are photos of the East Fork plan, and as you can see, there's a log that landed in the water course. But just to give you an idea for the dimensions, this log is about 1.5 feet in diameter and maybe 30 foot long. And so a log of that size could weigh up towards a ton. So that would cause a considerable amount of disturbance to the stream bank as it enters into the water course. So not only does the log go in, but so does any associated organic material and sediment that it brings with it as it travels down the bank. Again, here's another site on that same property with a log that ended up in the water course. Again, similar dimensions, 1.5 to 2 feet in diameter, 30 feet long, ended up down into the water course. And the reason that this is a concern is that I've gotten the question that, big deal, logs fall into the water course on their own. But this is an issue because not only is the logs falling into the water course and bringing sediment with it, but in the context of a logging operation, they might be pulled back out in order to be taken to the mill, whereas logs that are harvested or fall on their own are going to stay there and stay in place, and the water course will adapt to them. So it was the Department of Fish and Game provided the recommendation that these logs actually need to stay where they are. The forester can't pull them out and take them to the mill, and that way there's not going to be any further disturbance in those sites. And the purpose of the notice of violation on this site was failure to comply with the general waiver. It's a condition of the general waiver that the discharger call Water Board staff when something like this happens, take forensic monitoring of turbidity upstream and downstream, provide a report. They did not do that, so the notice of violation, I feel, got their attention that they need to report to the Water Board when such things occur. I'm not going to go into any further detail about the other plan I mentioned that had notices of violation. It's still under a multi-agency enforcement action, but I will keep the board apprised of the final outcomes of that enforcement action.
Julia, when did this happen?
Oh, that's a good question. Because I have the dates of the photos I took. I can't remember off the top of my head. Okay. But David Van Lennep is here. He might be able to answer that question. Do you want him to address that now?
No, he doesn't have to. I was kind of curious how you could sample. At least in the photo on the right, I really don't see any water in the creek. But the previous photo, was it at the same? That's a different location, right?
Right. This photo is just downstream of this photo.
Okay.
I had a question about, I know you don't want to talk about the other enforcement, but I saw that this was being referred to the Santa Cruz County DA.
Correct.
Is that common practice? I thought the Water Board did its own enforcement.
But when it's, just generally speaking, and I'll let Lori interrupt me if I speak too much on that issue, is when it becomes a multi-agency enforcement action, we'll work with the DA to come to some kind of solution or final result.
Some of the DAs have task forces where they do these multi-agency type of enforcement actions, and sometimes they charge them criminally, but often when there's several regulatory agencies involved, they proceed civilly.
Sure.
Go ahead.
On these multi-agency task force, when they're looking at enforcement, is just one of the agency bringing enforcement then, generally? In other words, go ahead.
It depends on the situation. Sometimes the DA is in the lead bringing either a civil or a criminal action, and our staff works with them kind of as support in their action. In some cases, we actually end up either bringing a separate enforcement action in addition to whatever result they get, either before the board or in a settlement of an ACL-type action. And some of the other agencies have different jurisdiction. There's licensing agencies and that sort of thing. So we could be looking at penalties. Another agency could be looking at a licensing action. The DA could be looking at a business and professions code violation.
Okay, thank you.
So I've conducted a preliminary analysis of the turbidity data that's been collected under the general waiver. So far we've received 1 year of turbidity data and temperature data since the general waiver has been adopted. And during my evaluation, I used two different types of evaluation criteria. The first that I took from the basin plan was anytime you see an increase in turbidity downstream from the upstream site, you want to further investigate, look into that, see what's going on, is there a potential impact to water quality. The second criteria I'm using is also one that the CCAMP uses that we pulled from the scientific literature. Anytime you see turbidity above NTU, an NTU of 25, that raises concerns about adverse impacts to salmonid species, steelhead trout, and coho salmon. So I reviewed several plans for turbidity. I decided to use this one as an example because it has upstream and downstream monitoring stations as well as a crossing in a class 2 up over here. The class 2 actually travels along here and down into the creek. This is the McLean plan. It's a 92-acre plan that's in the Coralitos Creek watershed. And as you can see here, this gold is the outline of the 92-acre plan. There's actually a 150-foot no-cut buffer from the plan to the stream. And there's a county road that runs along adjacent to this creek. So what you're looking at here is a bar chart of the turbidity data that was collected prior to any type of harvesting. The 25 NTU threshold is right along here, and as you can see, the turbidity readings exceeded that 25 NTU threshold. The yellow bars right here represent the error for the turbidimeter that they used to analyze these samples. It's a 5% error above or below the reading potentially, but that just puts into context the fact that our confidence in that number is right along here as compared to the downstream sample. And I also listed what the rain events were for each storm in which they collected that turbidity monitoring. This chart is a percent change in the NTUs from upstream to downstream, and as you can see, for all three samples, there was a decrease in NTUs from upstream to downstream on those same dates. So now what we're looking at here is another bar chart of the turbidity data collected post-harvest. The harvest was conducted in June of 2005. And as you can see, again, the turbidity readings are all above the 25 NTUs. What this red line represents, this correlates to the storms. And it might be tempting to try and analyze this data over time, but I'd like to remind the board that turbidity samples should be held in context of what that reading was for that site at that location at the time that the turbidity sample was taken. So moving on to the increase in turbidity for the first site, you can see that there was not that 20% change threshold that might raise a concern about what's happening with turbidity out on that plan. The second two did exceed the 20% change in NTUs. Now this data is looking at the data for that crossing on the western part of that plan, and especially taking into account that the turbidity data is much higher in the main stem. You can see that the turbidity readings are lower for each of these storms, especially the one taken in January during the 3-inch storm. They're below the 25 NTU thresholds, and as well as all three samples stay within that 20% change criteria that we're looking for. So now you would ask the question, so how is timber harvesting impacting water quality as far as turbidity is concerned? And I think that we could say that the data suggests that for that crossing at that time, those samples were taken, it was not adversely impacting the stream, but that sample is not representative of the entire plan. It's just representative of that crossing at that time. And then as far as the turbidity samples on the main stem water course, I would say that, in conclusion, that timber harvesting is definitely a factor in turbidity readings, but especially when we're looking at this data, it's not the sole contributor to turbidity. We have a county road up there. We have other portions of land draining into that water course. So, and as I mentioned in my staff report, I think that in order for us to more thoroughly analyze this data, I'm going to need to do some more spatial analysis and be able to take this data into context of what are other plans in that same watershed showing as far as turbidity, what are the other land uses upstream of that location, and then we'd be able to draw, I'd say, more sound conclusions about what the turbidity data is telling us. So moving on to the temperature data evaluation. The foresters are required to conduct continuous temperature monitoring over the summer. They place turbidity probes in the creek upstream and downstream of the plan, which collect temperature data on an hourly basis. And through my literature review, I found the Washington State Department of Ecology did a analysis of what are the most appropriate temperature ranges for juvenile rearing of steelhead trout and coho salmon, which are the two fish species of concern in Santa Cruz County. Well, particularly steelhead trout throughout the county and coho in the northern part. And they found that a temperature range between 15 and 18 degrees Celsius is the most appropriate for the juvenile rearing, which is what's happening during the summer, and that the lower lethal limit for those fish is 21 degrees Celsius, especially when those types of temperatures are sustained over a 7-day period. So the plan that I've chosen to use as an example of the temperature data is the Melee plan in the San Jacinto Creek. This is a 278-acre plan where San Jacinto Creek runs along the western boundary of that plan. And you can see here, this is where the temperature probes were put into the creek up here at the top as the creek enters the plan, and here towards the bottom where the water course is leaving the plan. So what we're looking at here is the continuous temperature sampling data for the summer of 2006. And the blue line represents the upstream sample, and the purple line above it represents the downstream sample. These two green lines represent that optimal threshold for juvenile rearing of the steelhead and the coho salmon. And that red line is the lower lethal limit, excuse me. So whenever you see temperatures rising above this line, for especially more than a 7-day period, that's going to draw concern about lethality for these fish. But as you can see, for the temperature readings on this plan over the summer of 2006, the temperature readings stay below or within the optimal range for steelhead and coho salmon, which again, the data suggests that we are within optimal thresholds for those fish. And I'll continue to analyze the data more thoroughly, again, using the spatial analysis and comparing these temperature readings that we're seeing from year to year and within the context of other timber harvest plans within that watershed. So in summary, I'm finding that a large majority of the timber harvest practices in Santa Cruz County appear to be protective of water quality. I'll continue to monitor activities, especially as I described in the staff report, and I'll be returning in 2008 with a more detailed review of water quality data, specifically using spatial analysis to place that into context. And I'll return to whichever meeting is held here in Watsonville for the stakeholders' convenience. So that concludes my presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Dr. Press.
So how many extra staff members do you need?
I don't know how to answer that question.
No. Seriously, you're out there. I'm assuming you're driving up from San Luis Obispo.
Correct.
There's a 0.6 FTE allocated to this position, unless that's changed.
That's correct.
You're logging a lot of times in the car.
Yes.
So, you know, that, never mind your other duties, and then paperwork.
Right.
I'm sure that the board wants more staff in every one of its departments.
Right.
But, you know, is it now that you've been implementing the waiver program, and you have some experience with how much time it takes, would it be possible for you to give a sense of how much more you could do and whether you could do your work a little more efficiently with either your position being increased to a full FTE and or another person? I know that we can always tell the state the state board that we need more people, but some areas maybe we need them more critically in. So
I believe it would be beneficial to have a second staff person that could spend time working with me on this program, especially having a second person rather than increasing my PY allocation would be beneficial, especially when it comes to schedule conflicts. Like, as you can see, I was able to attend 9 of the pre-harvest inspections, but sometimes it's impossible. It's impossible for me to go to 100% of them. So having a second person in that regard would be very beneficial.
Do you get any student interns and other kind of help?
I do have a student intern.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. You know, it would be helpful to have a copy of your slides if you
absolutely.
If you don't mind emailing them. That would be great.
Any other board questions, comments? Mr. Briggs?
I wanted to point out to the board, remind you that hopefully in your packet you have a letter. It was a supplemental from the Central Coast Forest Association. I just brought it in this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Julia, I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it.
Yes,
maybe,
I did.
Did you want to respond to a couple of the points? I think actually there are 2 points that have come up. The 2 main points have come up before.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
We've responded to them before.
Well, the first point I saw in that letter was the length of time it takes for me to enroll a general waiver. And I prepared a slide about that. I didn't include this in my regular presentation because I don't think it's an adequate way to evaluate my performance in this program. But this shows the average length of days and the longest and shortest amount of time that the enrollees had to wait to receive their general waiver from the first year that the general waiver was in place and then compared to this year. And as you can see, the average length of time has been reduced, and the longest amount of time has been reduced. I put an asterisk next to the 87 days. I didn't factor in one of the plans that took 160 days because when the enrollee submitted the request in February, they told me it could wait until July. So I'll take whatever I can get as far as that goes. But the reason I don't think that this is an adequate way to judge performance in this program is that it's not a matter of my just taking the time to look at these and process them. It's really a balance of priorities. And in that first year, I spent the first chunk of time on this program responding to a petition, and that took a lot of my time. And then that brought us into the winter, which extended the amount of time it took me to address general waivers. Over this last year, I did not have to respond to a petition, which gave me more time to focus on general waiver. But again, it's a very dynamic process. And so if I'm getting one waiver request at a time, it's easier for me to process in a short time period. But as opposed to now where I have seven waiting on my desk, it's going to stack up and take more time. So,
but clearly, if you had more help, you could get your average or your longest, even your average down.
Yes.
Right? That's a definite bottleneck.
Correct, because I am the only one working on these things. And my student helps me, but I can't expect her to carry it all the way through the completion. I need to review it for thorough, for correctness and so forth before I'm willing to send them over to Roger for his final approval.
Right.
Then the other thing that letter addressed is that clerical errors and typos should not be holding up the application. And I beg to differ with that statement, because the types of things that have been holding up the waivers are not just simply clerical errors and typos. There's discrepancies between the amount of watercourse crossings I'm seeing on the map versus what's reported. There's discrepancies about where the monitoring locations shall be located in the map. I have to send the map back and have them modify that. So I think that those are significant, and that it's important that those be correct before we issue a general waiver, especially since the fact that right now I'm managing a caseload of 67 plans, and so when I come back and want to do maybe a post-harvest inspection or evaluate for the data, I don't have time to spend figuring out whether or not it's correct. And then at that time, the applicant is not motivated to fix these errors for me. And so that would be my response to the letter.
There's also the temperature issue they were talking about, being required to take temperature readings with stream conditions that actually are contrary to the manufacturer of the equipment.
Thank you. Yeah, I forgot about that point. And I have been discussing with Chris modifying the standard operating procedures for temperature to include not monitoring when the station is dry, because they're correct in stating that in the letter, that it's not sensical to be deploying probes in a location where there's not water. It just doesn't make sense. So right now the standard operating procedures require the discharger to actually move the upstream probe downstream until they find water. But in some cases, that would put the upstream probe a few hundred feet from the downstream probe, and we're finding that the temperature readings are statistically basically the same. So I don't think that's worthwhile data collection. So we would like to modify the operating procedures to address that.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty common, especially with groundwater with shallow monitoring wells. A lot of times, groundwater fluctuations, they just have to report there's nothing to sample.
And what I've been asking the foresters to do in the meantime is, if you go out there and the site is dry, photo document it so that there won't be any questions for them. Write it down, document it in your logbooks, and take the probe out.
Okay. Mr. Hodgson.
Please help me understand 67 application plan that you have in hand, and you're approving 10 a year, and the longest is only 87 days. How does that all work out?
Well, the 67 is the number of timber harvest plans that I have on file that are either at some point into post-harvest, might still have a monitoring plan that's active or whatnot. But yeah, I get about 10. Well, this year I've gotten more than 10, actually, if we include the seven that are waiting. So I'm sorry, what was your bottom line?
Well, I was just trying to get the numbers straight. If there are 67 plans, you approve 10 a year, and the longest time it takes is 87 days, that just, I didn't understand how that would happen.
Yeah, there's the 67 plans are already approved, and then I get maybe a dozen a year.
67 already approved.
Correct.
I missed that point.
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry.
But
it's an important
there's
point.
There's still the ongoing workload with the monitoring, post-harvest inspections, that sort of thing. So those are active plans.
And then whenever there's a violation, that really eats up a lot of my time because I have to address that immediately. That's not something that can wait. So, and that's not something I can really plan for whenever there's going to be a violation. So it's definitely a layer in the situation.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
On page 4 of the staff report, you state here, staff regularly observes conditions that pose a threat to water quality.
Correct.
And its beneficial uses. I take it that these are at the pre-harvest inspection?
Correct.
Stage. And are those things that are only apparent to you or the other agencies that are involved in the pre-harvest inspection also picking up on those conditions?
They're also picking up on those conditions as well.
Okay. And how do we know that those conditions get corrected?
We discuss them with the forester, and some cases they become a condition of their timber harvest plan. I document them in my pre-harvest inspections, and then especially if it's a situation that I'm particularly concerned about, I'll make it a priority to go visit that plan again in the winter, that following winter after harvest is either complete or might be in midstream, and I follow up.
And you're taking photos of those?
Yes,
good.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm at least encouraged to see that you're trying to get to every pre-harvest inspection that you can, and knowing that you can't get to all of them, at least you are trying to follow up and get back to those sites as soon as you're able to.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the board has always felt it's important to have, you know, staff's time in the field observing so that we can identify things that need to be corrected. So I'm encouraged by that. Any other board comments or questions? We have a number of speakers that wish to address us. Anything else from staff at this point?
No.
Okay. Mr. Brick, shall we go to speakers?
Yep.
Okay. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have nine speakers. We'll start with Steve Dousman, Dick Burton, Bob Berluge, then Kevin Collins for starters. Everyone will have 3 minutes. Go
Good
ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and board members. I'm Steve Dousman, 2180 Eagle Tree Lane, Felton. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My wife, Linda, and I own and live on 320 acres in the Upper Newell watershed. We acquired the property in 1995, and during our early explorations determined there were 4 perennial streams that entered the land, and we named it Four Waters. From the beginning, we've been involved caretakers. Our many winter hikes were always with shovel and hoe to manage the water bars. Linda has personally planted over 1,000 trees. I've so far taken 33 credits of earth sciences courses at UCSC to better understand the geology and hydrology of Four Waters. In 2001, an NTMP was approved for Four Waters. We now, 17 years since the last harvest, find it appropriate to harvest part of the forest. On March 14th, we submitted our NOI, and last week we received our response. I was surprised when I read we needed to resubmit because of discrepancies. Items like the count and category of stream crossings, or referring to Dousman NTMP instead of Four Waters NTMP, could easily have been resolved by routine email. I'm most concerned that it's taken 4 months to get this far. But wait, let me step back and look at a bigger picture. Upper Newell is listed as impaired with a problem of sedimentation. After over a decade of personally monitoring the streams during and after storms, including subsequent upstream timber harvests, the problem is apparent. I have no reason to think this will change. We concurred with staff during the field inspection in February to perform turbidity monitoring at several critical locations. We want to provide these data and hope it leads to improved water quality. Please help us get there. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Well, is there anything specific that you're asking the board for? I mean, staff has heard, you've been in contact with staff on this, correct?
My forester has, yes.
And have your revisions been resubmitted?
No, we just got this letter I received it last Wednesday.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
All right. Dick Burton.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Dick Burton. I retired in 1997 after 10 years at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, where I worked as a mechanical engineer. My primary job there involved instruments to collect photographic, biologic, geologic, and water samples, as well as systems to deploy them in Monterey Bay. Pardon me. My family owns 200 acres with an NTMP in Santa Cruz County. The first parcel was purchased in 1957. The timberland is divided into four units. The one along the west branch of Soquel Creek is designated no cut. Last year I applied for a water waiver in May. Your staff was very helpful throughout the process. I anticipated that waiver in early July instead of late August. We had only enough time to cut and haul part of the unit and will finish this month. The delay could have cost $15,000. We were fortunate that the mill receiving material honored the price from last year. It certainly cost them a lot of money. As part of the application process, I learned that over the previous 15 years, the average annual harvest in the watershed was about 66 acres. The 27 acres of our harvest represents about one half of 1% of the watershed. At a 15-year reentry, it's 0.03% per year. Last year, I went through the turbidity sampling process and found that it takes about 4 hours to sample the two sites. In the past, we've had storm systems that probably meet the 2-inch criteria several days during a week's time. I would prefer to spend that time walking the property with a rake and shovel, preventing problems at times when problems are most likely to occur, rather than collecting the data, which I consider of questionable value. I hope the process is not counterproductive to water quality. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Berlage, followed by Kevin Collins and then Catherine Moore.
Chairman Young, is that all right, sound-wise?
Yes.
Okay.
I hear you.
Okay. Chairman Young and members of the board, my name is Bob Berlage. I'm here representing Big Creek Lumber Company and appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today and to make comments. I've also submitted a letter that includes some concerns and observations, none of which are new, and our staff has been in constant contact with water quality staff. I'm going to reiterate a couple of those here today, but I want to take a moment and underscore a very critical comment that Dr. Press made. It's extremely important to us, and we've said this on a number of occasions in the past, to get documentation and authorization and waivers from you, because as you're well aware, your process doesn't begin until we've gone through a very lengthy public process to get the permits from California Department of Forestry. And so I would like to reiterate what Dr. Press said. If there's any way to get more staffing to help expedite these applications and the very critical review. Our company is extremely supportive of staff being out on the ground during the PHI and also afterwards. One of the photographs that Julia showed is very telling. Had an opportunity to go out there on a couple of occasions, as demonstrated by those photographs, and to recognize existing problems, which may or may not have had anything to do with our harvesting activity, but a tremendous opportunity to mitigate those problems as part of this permitting process. And that's frankly something that our industry has been doing here on the Central Coast for quite some time. But if we don't have staff out there and there isn't the opportunity to address this or to have staff attend pre-harvest inspections, then all of that review gets backloaded on the far end of the process and extends the amount of time necessary for us to get proper permits. It's a serious issue. If there's anything that our company can do to help convince state authorities or whoever the powers that be to get that help, we would like to participate in that. One of the things that hasn't been mentioned yet, but in addition to delays in receiving waiver applications, is an issue of receiving first year-end authorization to move into second-year monitoring. And it looks like I'm out of time. Is that correct?
You could wrap it up.
Okay. Yeah. So one last thing, and this is in our letter. One of the things that did not occur to us during the initial creation of this general waiver is that theoretically a landowner or applicant or his representative would be obligated to do monitoring on weekends and holidays, and I'd like to make a recommendation that the general waiver get modified so that the very first work day after a monitoring triggering event occurs on a holiday or weekend, the very first regular work day becomes the day for monitoring, you know, so we don't have staff out on Christmas Eve in the middle of a rainstorm collecting water samples. Looking forward to the opportunity to continue to work with this board and also with staff, and hope you get a chance to look at some of our concerns as expressed in our letter. Thank you.
We've read the letter, and I appreciate it. And I'll tell you, it's very frustrating, you know, as the chair of the board who has made requests to the State Water Resources Control Board for more staff for various projects. And, you know, there just isn't the money available. We don't control our budget.
But maybe you have great friends and call upon them to intervene on our behalf.
I don't know how close we are to some of those particular people, but we can certainly shoot them a letter.
Yeah, you know, the part of the comparison is you look at the amount of timber harvested in the other regions, like Region 1, and, you know, they immediately make that comparison to me. And, you know, they look at the amount of timber produced here is relatively small compared to up there. And, you know, we've got maybe proportionally about the same amount of staff involved.
Right. And as I mentioned in the letter, there may be some mechanisms that they're using. Front-loading observations during a pre-harvest inspection might be an opportunity for staff to be prepared once we jump into the second process, which is your permitting process, to review that stuff. But, you know, it clearly this board needs more people.
Agreed. And we're receptive to any, you know, positive criticism on how to, you know, get to that point with even some things that are beyond our control. But I agree with you.
Well, somebody gets a letter from the regulated public asking for more regulators, that might catch their attention.
Yeah. They'll accuse us of having written it, I'm sure. Okay. Yeah, I didn't see this. That's the one who's okay. All right. Mr. Collins.
Good afternoon.
It's just a minute. Hang on just one second.
We have a couple of chairs here. There's a chair that's got a bunch of stuff here for those of you who are standing in the back. I don't know if there are any. Are there any other empty chairs? There's one here and there. Oh, okay, so there are empty chairs available. You don't have to stand the whole time.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi.
Thank you. Kevin Collins, Long Pico Watershed Conservancy. As most of you here are aware, I spent 3 years coming down to meetings while the board established its general waiver. And some of the items that I was discussing back at that time are still pertinent, I think. But I'll jump just to the report that you received. The report makes reference to additional site-specific requirements that are a condition for the general waiver. In other words, I presume this means that when an applicant comes in with a THP, the staff may ask for, say, a road alignment to be moved. I mean, this is what the pre-harvest inspection process is about when the review team takes place with Fish and Game, the county, the regional board in some cases, and Mines and Geology and CDF. So, but now with this ministerial process, what conditions the board staff may be asking for are no longer available to someone reviewing the timber harvest plan as a member of the public, because your staff is not part of the review team. They're not writing review team comments. And so if there are conditions established by the water board, I don't get to see what they are necessarily unless I write a Government Records Act request to get a look at it. I presume occasionally there are additional requests, say to move a landing or a skid trail or something like that, right? Is that what this sentence refers to? Okay. But previously when the regional board acted as a member of the review team and submitted review team comments, which is really the legal process that's part of the CEQA equivalency that's necessary for a THP review, those items were transparent to me or anybody else who might be reviewing the THP, but now they're an internal issue that I may have no opportunity to know about. And yet I have to comment on the timber harvest plan without knowing what the regional board may be asking for in addition. I'll just go ahead here because I need to be quick about my comments. There's a reference here to the need to conduct storm-based turbidity monitoring on or after a certain period of the year, and there'll be evaluation. I think, you know, in a year from now when the board does its evaluation of the three-year process, that's when I hope we'll all look at the data and kind of decide whether this is working the way everybody wanted it to. There's a line here on page 5. I'll just try to do this real quickly. Over the past year, foresters have filed 29 different amendments. These are changes to the THP after CDF approval. In other words, the plan is modified after it's approved, and apparently the regional board wants to see what these modifications are, but it doesn't indicate whether those would have triggered any additional requests for modifications to the activity of the plan. In other words, it just refers to the monitoring reporting program. And then I'll just jump to my final comment, which has to do with the turbidity monitoring criteria here. And the connection between rainfall incidents, when it's happening, how intense it is, and the turbidity readings you're going to get out of a stream are, and Brian Dietrich here, the hydrologist from Cal Poly, brought his graphs. You see spikes like this. Turbidity jumps to maybe 500 NTUs and drops to a couple hundred in a few hours in some cases. So I think the reporting needs to have pretty solid information about the relationship between the rainfall event, say the limb of the hydrograph, whether the stream was rising or falling, and when the actual sample was taken. Otherwise, the data is going to be very hard to use. Thank you.
Thank you. I have some questions for you, and this has to do with what information is available for a member of the public that wants to look at, you know, comments that staff is making after pre-harvest inspection and things of that nature? Seems like Mr. Collins is really looking for the paper trail involved and how comments and changes are being made to harvest plans. Is that correct?
Yeah, since the regional board is not formally writing its pre-harvest, pre-harvest, excuse me, review team comments and so on, it's doing it separately.
What is available that Julia, you're generating just as part of your process?
There's not something available for him to review as part of that process. When there's a pre-harvest inspection, they request that you write your pre-harvest report and submit it to them within a certain amount of time. Otherwise, it'll extend the time for approval. So I have not been submitting pre-harvest reports to the California Department of Forestry. Mm. Instead, I come back to the office and work on the applications for the general waivers that have already been requested for, and then address that plan at the time that they request to be enrolled under the general waiver. So he's correct. There's not some type of formal documentation that he has to review as part of that process.
Not that he has to review, but that he could review.
Excuse me, it's available for him to review.
It's available, right.
Excuse me, yes. All of the waivers that she processes, though, have an inspection report attached to them. And so I review those inspection reports, and they are available.
They are what?
They are available to the public. I suppose we could, maybe we could make arrangements for somehow getting those to the public. I'm not sure. Maybe we could post them on the website.
Well, he's certainly an interested person to this whole process in Santa Cruz County. Can he be on some mailing list where this material is just sent out to him?
Why don't I talk to Mr. Collins and figure out a way that...
Or even if you scanned it and made it available on our website.
Put it on the website.
Yeah.
That would be entirely adequate. I mean, CEO has a site like that.
And that would make it easy for you guys, too. I mean, you can do that once, and it's there.
I can certainly do that.
Yeah. Mr. Shellcross?
I have a question, and I don't know if this is an issue for you. It sounds to me like when you generate your report, it's after the comment time you would need to comment on the THP.
Right, the THP closes comment, and then the regional board issues it separate.
So I'm wondering if your report would be on the website in time for Mr. Collins to review it before he has to comment on the THP.
It would not.
Because you don't generate it within that time period, is that right?
Correct.
And she doesn't have enough time either.
No, I know. I understand. I'm just trying to figure out the logistics here.
But then again, we did that on purpose because we wanted the process to finish before we went into our process. I mean, that was actually a comment from the environmental community that we were trying to do our process concurrent with the CDF process, and the environmental community actually commented on that and asked us to wait until they were done. And so it's a tough one to answer.
I remember making that request, but once the legislature more or less separated the regional board's permit, discharge permit from the categorical waiver, then it became a separate process. But in any case, when I comment on THP, I may not know that the regional board has made a recommendation to move some landing or to shut down some road segment or something that could be pretty important to the terms of the THP. And it would be certainly important to a commenter on a logging plan. It's a complicated interaction because you guys used to be part of the review team, but now you're not really acting, even though Julia tries to go out on the review team, the pre-harvest inspection. Not acting as a member of the review team is a big difference to acting separately as a separate reviewing agency. Yeah. I don't exactly have a solution necessarily, but as soon as the information is available, the better.
So, Chris, you'll work to try to get our material available for the public, disseminated in a way that Mr. Collins.
I can certainly make it available to the public, but whether or not it will be in the kind of timely manner that Mr. Shellcross is talking about, so that the public can actually reintroduce it into the CDF process.
Right. We understand that.
Okay.
We understand that that's a constraint that we may not be able to deal with.
I can certainly get it up on the web.
Okay. Any other board comments or questions on this particular little issue right here? Okay. Catherine Moore, then Cheyenne Borello, Jody Frediani, David Van Lennep, and then Brian Dietrich.
Hello, my name is Catherine Moore. I'm with the Central Coast Forest Association. I'm also a landowner with 160 acres up in the Newell Creek drainage. I'm very gratified to see that you got my letter and that you also have addressed several of the points on it, and it sounds like we're starting to get on the same page. It's really nice to see that. I've got just one last comment on there on the collection of data, more on the order of it's only being collected in timber zones. I was a statistics major. I've got, I was trained not only in crunching numbers, but on, gathering numbers. And if you're getting data from one spot only under your microscope, you think that's the whole picture, and it's not. We get a big storm, and it's not just the forest that's moving. It's all the housing developments and all the rest of that. They're happily feeding stuff into my creek. I've had January 1st of 2006, we had ourselves a pretty good-sized storm blasting through. And from the properties outside of my territory, I got a couple of freight trains blasting through into my territory and out the other side, and if I were the only person collecting data, it would have been on me. This bugs me. Why isn't there any data on public parks, for instance, to see if our private forest lands and the public parks are responding the same way? Where's the data on public roads? Where's the data on housing developments? Where's the data on the local vineyards? I mean, we're all intermingled on top of each other in the same drainage, and we're getting private forests as your entire snapshot. This doesn't cover the picture at all, and it kind of feels like we're being picked on a little. I don't know whether that's rather bad analogy, but it's just that everybody ought to be having looked at in the same view and not just one land use. That way we can get a much, much more comprehensive picture of what's going on in a watershed. And I just want to throw that out for consideration to the board as we continue with trying to figure out how to keep these streams working the way they're supposed to be working. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Dr. Press?
This has annoyed all of us for a long time. Every time this topic comes up, it annoys all of us. The short, glib answer is that we have more powers with a regulatory oversight that triggers review and data collection than we do for non-regulatory. And this county of Santa Cruz knows about this. The county of Santa Cruz has limited powers. It has a road program. It would be good for us to hear from them again. I think it's been a while since we've heard from the county's road program. But it comes down to money. You see our staff problems.
Yes, I see the staff problems.
So it's appalling. But you're absolutely right. But it is again this sort of we don't have a regulatory stick that we can easily wield if it's not permit or violation driven.
Yeah, it's just that we don't feel like we are ought to be the ones that are being spanked.
I understand.
For somebody else's transgression.
I understand. I understand, and you're absolutely right. But we've not yet come up with the magic silver bullet to address this. But
Well, we'd appreciate it if you'd take all this under advisement as new rules are being created, and that would certainly help.
Well, as new powers are being created, let's regulate more. but to get a holistic picture, we would need at least more capacity in the region, in that part of our region, to do the data collection. I mean, there are isolated examples. Cal Poly has been doing some great work up there, but it tends not to be, you know, very wide. So you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Kind of a question for us. How much of the San Lorenzo TMDL encompasses that chart that was set up there? You know, Julia, do you have that
Which chart?
Could you put your first chart back up there? It had the different watersheds.
Sure.
You're talking about the sediment?
The timber, yeah. Well, it's sediment, but we are talking about sediment, I think.
Do you mean
this
map right here?
I turned off the water.
Yeah. We're not wearing wearing your special glasses, Julia.
We have another.
Maybe Gary is.
We have another TMDL cooking for San Lorenzo for pathogens.
But I think you're
thinking about sediment.
Well, sediment, that's the issue that drives pretty much all this. So where are we at? That TMDL is completed. Maybe we need to, when we come back up here, at our next board meeting that's at Salinas, maybe we can get a status report on the implementation of that TMDL.
Sure. What was your question as far as the extent of it?
So it's just the San Lorenzo River. So does the TMDL then cover that purple big swath?
Well, tributaries are included when you have an impaired water. So, yeah, it is pretty sweeping.
Okay.
And the pathogen one actually includes Soquel and Aptos as well, if I remember correctly. That'll be coming before you early next year.
Mm-hmm. But for sediment, we only have San Lorenzo River.
And the Pajaro. And the San Vicente Creek was just listed for turbidity.
So they'll be getting TMDLs at some point?
Correct.
Okay. Well, you know, we've had this discussion, I think, before, mainly with Lisa McCann, in terms of what do we do about all of these other uses in these watersheds that we know contribute sediment. So maybe we can just have a status report, and you know, the public could learn with us where we're at in terms of getting a handle on the county's participation in addressing sedimentation.
Okay.
Yep, more cards. Cheyenne Borello.
Good afternoon. My name is Cheyenne Borello. I'm a registered professional forester for Staub Forestry. I'd like to provide the board with information regarding the current status of waiver applications that have been submitted just since January of this year. To my knowledge, 7 waiver applications have been submitted to water quality staff, 1 in February, 3 in March, 1 in April, and 2 in the beginning of June. Of these 7 waivers, only 1 has been processed and enrolled. This waiver took 56 working days to get approved and is for a 22-acre harvest, includes 2 photo points, and no temperature or turbidity data. The waiver application that has been in the process the longest is currently at 94 working days. To date, this waiver application is for 13 acres that has only 1 Class 3 watercourse and no watercourse crossings. At last year's board meeting, and at the request from local foresters to have applications be accepted earlier in order to help expedite the process, the Water Board staff began accepting applications at a planned close of public comment instead of plan approval. Staff's follow-up report after the 2006 meeting stated, "Water Board staff will continue to balance priorities to accommodate the workload associated with the timber harvest program. Therefore, just prior to and during the timber harvest season, processing applications for enrollment will be a priority, and processing time should be quicker. There are currently 6 applications that are waiting to be enrolled in the process. Our logging season is approximately 170 days. We cannot effectively operate under these administrative conditions. For plans that have been enrolled under an MRP, if an MRP is nearing the end of year one monitoring period, the annual report must include a request for Water Board staff to inspect the plan area, and you must receive written confirmation from the Water Board's executive officer to proceed to year two. On January 18th and 19th, staff visited 2 different properties that we manage, specifically to determine if they can move forward to year two monitoring. The 2 properties have a total of 3 different MRPs. At these field visits, we received verbal agreement for these MRPs to move forward to year two, but to date, we have not received written confirmation from the EO. To date, no other landowner that has requested year two determination has received written confirmation from the EO, and these MRPs will soon be entering year three. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Have you addressed this with staff?
Yes, staff is very good about returning emails, returning calls, and telling us that, you know, next week, you know, their workload, you know, I'm not familiar with everything that they do, but right. We're always constantly asking, and we get no answers.
Any comments, Julia, on... Is it just that the
Yeah, and a response to that.
Okay.
I prepared a slide for that. One moment. So this is the slide representing the applications that are still waiting for approval. The 2, I don't, which one is the one that you're referring to that's waited 94 days?
Amity Basin?
Mm-hmm. My calculations are different for that day.
Well, you know, 94 versus 81, that's right. Still a long time.
It is a long time, and yeah. I sympathize with that length of time. I processed the waivers in the order in which they were received. The 2 that are waiting now had incomplete applications, and I provided them with a letter explaining exactly what those inconsistencies were. Actually, the Little Buck one has been processed and is waiting for approval. And the time... frames do get extended during times when I'm addressing things such as violations, and I've been preparing a staff report, and I'm not looking for kudos, but I do work. I've worked weekends, I've worked nights, I've worked on holidays. I'm doing everything I can to try to process these as quickly as I can, and it's just I have more work than I can do, to be quite honest. This isn't a matter of being just sitting on them for no reason.
This might not be on. I forgot about my other thought, but I wish there was something I could say. I wish there was something I could say about being able to process these more quickly. Oh, the other thought was about the request to move to year two monitoring. That's correct. I have not been able to make that a priority to transfer those plans over to year two monitoring, but I have had a discussion with the forester that I'll backdate that letter so they're not having to continue to do the year one monitoring until that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you for your comments. Jody Fradiani, followed by David Van Lennep, and then Brian Dietrich.
Thank you, Chairman Young, members of the board. I'd like to just say, I'll start by saying I concur with the comments about one, needing more staff time, either better utilization of time or more staff. And I'll just say, I submitted no petitions this year, nor have I actually even called or emailed your staff, so I have nothing to do with the slowdown this year. At any rate, really, really, really would like to see full participation in the timber harvest review process. That's the CEQA process, the CEQA document that the waiver is based on. It's where the public can comment. It's also where staff can collaborate with other review team members. The usual process that Fish and Game, California Geological Survey, CDF, and the county, they all attend almost all of the pre-harvest inspections. They all, except for your water board, submit written pre-harvest inspection reports. It's a way of documenting what has taken place in the field. It's a way of other agencies seeing it. It's a way of creating a history. It's a way of making sure that the concerns are there so that the public can also participate, either support staff in their recommendations, make additional recommendations. We're not allowed in the field. We don't know what's going on. We can't see those issues. Then there's the review team, which is where things are hammered out, and all of the other agencies participate. They can participate by conference call. They don't have to drive to Felton. Would really like to see that happen so that that process is complete and transparent. In addition, we were disappointed, we understand there's a lot more information presented today, but disappointed that there was no data. I mean, we've had 2 years, we heard this was going to be, now we've got some turbidity data, some temperature data, we can actually take a look at this. Since that hasn't happened, what we'd like to see happen in the future, either in the short term or long term, is a spreadsheet showing even more information about the inspections, the timing of winter inspections. Are they happening in the winter? Are they not? Turbidity data and temperature data, not just a sample, but so we can get a broad picture of it. The spreadsheet, we understand in the staff report, visual inspections, data collection relative to rainfall events, when this is taking place, so we can get a chance to see, are we getting useful data from the process? Are we not getting useful data? How do we need to change it? And until that's there, I think it's premature to remove the monitoring requirements on the level two tier plans that have been processed as tier three, because we did that because we didn't know whether the requirements were appropriate or not. If staff hasn't had a time to review that data, then I suggest that we keep that extra tier three in place until that is done. Also understand that staff is working on a possible change to the standard operating procedures that industry has requested, and I would like to request that that also be a transparent process whereby the public is informed of what is being considered and has an opportunity to comment on it.
For turbidity, you mean? The SOP for turbidity?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So I think that's the... That's the bulk of my comments. I will say that I'm glad to see that staff is working on violations, and there's two violations on one plan. And just so you're aware, that came to staff's attention because the public had concerns about other violations that were going on. Actually brought those concerns to me. I brought those to our county staff person. That set in motion additional inspections. And I know that I do understand from a conversation I had earlier today with Julia that she is going out on most of these plans to do post-harvest inspections, say, within the year following, because then there's a change in the monitoring requirements. But there was something in the staff report about 3 to 5 years. Even in this particular case, going out a year later, the violation would have not been visible. The logs would have been pulled out of the creek since there wasn't reporting by the applicant or the so obviously the more staff can get in the field, we concur with the timber industry. We'd like to see staff in the field early on, later in the process, a way to gain information and put that information, in a form that's accessible so we can review it as well.
Thank you for your comments. And let me try to address two things. One is certainly make your evaluation and response on the turbidity SOP available to the public so that they can see, what the evaluation is and, what your comments are. And secondly, what state is the database in, the monitoring database? Is it in a spreadsheet at this point? Is it?
Yes, it's held in Access database.
Okay. Is it in a form that you can make it available to the public?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess you just have to request it. And you'll get at least whatever's in whatever form it's in.
Yes. I mean, I will say that, you know, if I want to review timber harvest files, I can walk into the Felton office, with any luck they're open, and access the files. If I want to see, you know, I don't need to make an appointment. If I want to see files in the county that the county has, right. I can call our staff person, and she's available. I can come in and look at them. To get your files, you know, to get access on one, you know, you're several hours away, but also apparently I need to call 10 days in advance. And the CDF now has the timber harvest stuff on an FTP site. I don't think your information is there yet. I'm just saying it's an opportunity to somehow make the information more accessible,
yeah.
And that would be really appreciated.
Can we do that? We can do it. I mean, it sounds like it would help because they're so much further away from our office.
Yeah, I don't know why we couldn't put the spreadsheet on the
this stuff could be scanned, and there could be a link just to, you know, the
we already have the Access database.
Yeah,
it should all just be dumped in there so that they can don't have to drive or even call, but download it.
Exactly.
I'm assuming that you'd probably want to work with that data, so maybe we can get an FTP site together so that you can actually download the Access database so that you can manipulate the data somehow. Not manipulate, but use the data.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
So I'm just having a hard time hearing this.
We'll try to put it on an FTP site so that you can actually take the Access database.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. David Van Lennep, and last speaker is Brian Dietrich.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, members of the board. My name is David Van Lennep, registered professional forester working for Redwood Empire Sawmills. First of all, I'd like to compliment staff on their efforts to get onto the PHIs, pre-harvest inspections. I know it's a scheduling problem, and any comments pertaining to the processing of the waivers is not meant to suggest that staff is not working at her full capacity, merely that there's a complicated process that we're all installed in that is cumbersome for staff and for applicants, and we're frustrated with the overall timeline, but staff has been very forthright with us about her availability and her efforts to do that, so just wanted to make that clarifying point. We also support staff's access to an all-terrain vehicle, which will help her get out in the field during winter inspections and winter pre-harvest inspections with the rest of the review team. And I believe that staff, as part of the original waiver order in 2005, will be is mandated to look at this all the collected data and do a review after or no later than 30 months. I think that was the timeline that was set forth. I'd like to talk a little bit about the turbidity SOP that was sent to all existing waivers by staff in October of 06, and we had submitted a letter this May with some changes that we had requested. And some of those had to do with the requesting of calibration accuracy checks that exceeded manufacturers' expectations or requirements, some field collection procedures that were logistically impractical, like keeping the water temperature at 4 degrees Celsius for some period of time, overly prescriptive bottle sampling requirements and things where there hadn't really been any problem demonstrated, and seems appropriate to let people work it out on their own unless there's some problem. Stage gauge measurements where at the turbidity sampling location we would make some guesstimate of stream stage, flood stage, which is a free-handed guess at best without any other information about falling leg, rising leg, the hydrograph, how much rain has fallen. There's so many factors that would be sort of a ridiculous number to even guess at. And repetitious monitoring or resampling of the sample that we grabbed from the actual monitoring site. The resampling is sort of an artificial accuracy security blanket. It doesn't really increase the accuracy of the original sample, and the machines that we're working with are so much more precise than the grab sampling that we're doing in the field. It seems like a repetitive and sort of ridiculous exercise, and all that is in our letter. Also, I had spoken some about the timeline issue. We are also frustrated with the amount of time it's taken, and we would like to work with staff on some suggestions on how to streamline that, maybe looking at other regions and trying to figure out some way we can streamline that. Also, I'd be happy at the board's pleasure to answer any questions or have any discussion about the East Fork NOV that occurred and any of the situations. I have a letter here that I can submit to staff, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know the board is concerned about that, and I'd be happy to talk about that at length.
Probably don't need to. I mean, these things happen all the time. They get NOV'd, and they get corrected. So, you know.
And this was something that we as the landowner brought to the attention of the agencies, not water quality directly, which was kind of the source of the NOV, but we did bring the issue up to other agencies, and we worked through the process with water quality. And just for the record, this was not one that had gone to any further action. The NOV was the end of the action, and other agencies were also satisfied with the result.
And I think that's the way the board receive that information. So,
thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Oh, pardon me.
Actually,
Dr. Hunter, did you want to ask?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a quick question of
Mr.
Julian.
Van Lennep, if you got a.
I'm sorry,
yes.
I just wanted to ask a staff question, and you might have a comment of Julia regarding have you had an opportunity to look at other regions to see if there are ways to learn from their procedures or ways to streamline some of the and perhaps affect the timeline for approving the applications?
Yeah, I have been in discussion with them. It seems that their waiver approval process or equivalent processes seem to be very different from what we're requiring in this region. I'm not prepared to discuss that in any great kind of detail, but in my opinion, the limitations seem to be that my time and the different tasks that I have on my plate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
I did have a comment, if it would please the board.
Yes.
Just in my familiarity with the other regions that do require waivers or waste discharge permits, our region has a much more complex, much more involved, much more mechanically cranked through kind of process that does absorb more of staff's time per application or per capita than other regions. And that was just one of the things that we had identified early on, that it was going to be very labor intensive for staff to go through a lot of these mechanical functions like the tiering. And even though we submit a fairly complex and fairly rigorous application with a lot of these numbers in, you know, for staff to put them through the matrix, they still have to pull those out. Staff feels obligated to check that for their own due diligence, and I think it is very consumptive of time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Dr. Hunter, were you on the board when we got to the point that the matrix was developed?
I think it was either in process just as I came aboard,
yeah,
and it was completed.
There's been a lot of water under the bridge,
yeah,
with the board trying to,
yeah,
come up to speed with this whole issue. And we don't have a lot of easy solutions,
yeah,
to grapple, you know, with it. But that, you know, matrix alone took a lot of staff time to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Price?
I just want to make it clear that nobody should be impugning Julia for her work. I mean, she's really done working very hard. And remember, this is 60% only of her position. It's not 100%, even though she's probably spending 160% on it. So whether it's futile or not, it probably is a moment when this board, joined by the regulated community and the environmental community, should come together and articulate not just that there needs to be more staffing for this kind of work in this region, but also precisely why the high quality of the process that that we would like to follow is justification for that. So it's not just because we could be compared with other regions and say, well, you know, on a per harvest plan, this is how much you should get. But our process, we could argue, is more intended to be more transparent. And by the way, did you notice that we all just gave her more work today? So, you know, it has to be taking into account the nature of the work, not just that there's some ratio in the state of work to FTE. So I would like to see us join with all the parties involved and make yet again another plea and pitch and reasoned argument, maybe with everybody coming in together. That will be so rare and unusual that it will, you know. Okay, there you have it.
Well, we'd have to do it, I think, you know, when the budget process is up, comes for review.
Yeah, and just to add something, you know, Assemblymember Laird, who is represents Santa Cruz area, is the chair of the Assembly Budget Committee. So I think he would be a good place for folks to start. Pick up on Dr. Press's recommendation, if the regulated community and the environmental community could get together and sort of show a united front on this, it would go a long way. So I think in Assemblymember Laird, you've got a good person there to get in touch with who can actually make something happen with the budget.
When are we keyed into the budget process with the state board?
Yeah, we've got the...
When does that start?
Right about now for the 08-09
okay, really?
Budget.
Yeah. Well, I think what we should do is try to put together some plan where we enlist both all of our stakeholders in this, and maybe it's lobbying the State Water Board.
Yeah, we have to handle our budget requests internally, if you recall.
I know, yeah.
But there would be some... We almost have to have two separate processes, really.
Right.
As opposed to a united front, other than maybe having a common interest that's apparent.
Let's continue, you and I, to think about how we're going to do this and just keep it on our list of things we're working on.
Right.
Okay. All right. Brian Dietrich, last speaker.
Chairman Young, members of the board, my name's Brian Dietrich. I'm the director of Swanton Pacific Ranch. I'm also a professor at Cal Poly, but possibly more importantly here, I'm the principal investigator of the Little Creek Project on Swanton Pacific Ranch. It's a long-term study to evaluate water quality. Or let's say it's not even a water quality study. It's more or less an effectiveness study. How effective are our practices in protecting water quality? And I just want to make a few comments, and I might even offer up a solution that lightens Julia's workload. I don't know. But the tiered system, I think, has some merit, and I think it has worked out well, but I think it is the type of monitoring that is problematic. Storm event-based sampling is very difficult because of the sediment responses and how much variability there is associated with these storm events. And it's a very difficult thing to try and expect compliance monitoring or cause and effect monitoring to be able to detect some sort of change when the variability is so great, not only between locations, but also between storm events. The other difficulty has to do with turbidity itself and whether it is a true surrogate of suspended sediment in these mountain watersheds. It's been shown to work in some places. We have difficulty with it on a regular basis, looking at relationships between turbidity and suspended sediment changing almost from one event to the next. So I guess I have problems with the level of monitoring, particularly when it's for grab sampling and it's between or upstream and downstream from a harvest area. I would suggest that the only monitoring requirements that you currently have that have any merit is above and below a crossing. And even then, there's some difficulty because you're doing it based on grab sampling. You have a 24-hour period after the storm event ends, I believe, is the way it's written currently. And it's very difficult to collect the data you want to collect to be able to show some type of effect. So as a result of that, I'm more in line to support some type of ground-based monitoring that is on the ground after the events have occurred to determine whether there is, in fact, a problem or not, because I don't think the data that we're collecting is really the type of data that you can use effectively to determine whether there's change. Thank you.
I vividly remember your, was it the paired studies?
Yes.
Yeah, presentation you've made. Yeah, I mean, a lot of that has not left my mind in terms of the challenges in using turbidity sampling and data. Yeah.
Well, there's a staff letter or a letter to the board and the staff that I prepared in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
That is still pertinent today, and there is also a master's thesis that was recently completed that if the staff doesn't have it, we should see that you get it. And it illustrates pretty well the difficulty in collecting this type of data,
mm-hmm.
and that this is a scientific study, and we experience lots of difficulties, and I think it's a huge undertaking to try and expect to do it with any type of ground sampling effort.
Mm. Thank you for your comments. Okay, anyone else wish to address the board on this agenda item before we move on? Okay. Mr. Briggs, do you want to wrap this up for us?
Well, we had a number of homework assignments, as Dr. Press pointed out. While we're talking about Julia being spread thin, we added a few tasks to her, but I think there are things that are pretty doable, things like adding to the website some information and on the inspection reports and the access database, and some things that are coming up in the due course of our business as far as the turbidity SOP, and we make that available to the public. So we will soldier on, and as Julia said, we're planning another update at our next Northern meeting. Is that it, Julia? Thanks. And also, I don't think the board received the letter from Bob Berlage, so we'll provide copies for you on that. And Jody Fradiine, did you hand in a letter?
Yes, she did.
Okay, we'll get copies of that to the board as well. Oh, and then the sediment TMDL status report that okay. You asked for.
All right. Should we take 12 next instead of 11?
Yes. We're going to skip.